This is a Kim Monson news briefing. Jesse Jackson had an angle. He was the most important civil rights leader of the generation after King. He spent six decades proving he was not worthy of the comparison. A Kim Monson Show editorial. The mythology and the man. Jesse Jackson was present at the Lorraine Motel on April 4, 1968, when a bullet struck Martin Luther King Jr. on the second floor balcony. This is confirmed. Everything else Jackson said about that moment is disputed. Jackson told the world that King died in his arms. He appeared on national television the following morning, wearing a turtleneck allegedly stained with King's blood, positioning himself visually as the anointed successor. King's speechwriter Alfred Duckett questioned this account. Ralph Abernathy, King's closest friend and the man who succeeded him as president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, went further. In his 1989 memoir, And the Walls Came Tumbling Down, Abernathy alleged that Jackson had been in the courtyard below when the shot was fired, not on the balcony beside King, and that Jackson had deliberately dipped his shirt in King's pooled blood the following morning. Abernathy's memoir made plain what he believed Jackson's true ambition was, not to continue King's work, but to become King's replacement. Jackson denounced the memoir as slander. Abernathy maintained his account, insisting that Jackson had not told the truth about what happened at the Lorraine Motel. The argument over where Jackson stood in the seconds after the shot is, in a sense, a small thing. People remember crises differently. Adrenaline disorders memory. What matters is what the story reveals about the man, that before King was buried, Jackson was shaping the narrative to center himself, even at the expense of those who had actually been there. A 1972 New York Times Magazine profile identified the pattern early. The writer described Jackson as a brilliant speaker, a skilled mobilizer who was also vain and self-seeking, a star, a man of great ambition, a man who, at times, uses the tricks of a demagogue. That was published 54 years ago. It could run unchanged today. Jesse Lewis Jackson Sr. died on February 17, 2026, at his home in Chicago, at age 84. He had been living for more than a decade with a progressive neurological illness, initially diagnosed as Parkinson's disease in 2013, according to his family, publicly disclosed in 2017, and reclassified as progressive supranuclear palsy in April 2025. The family said he died peacefully, surrounded by those who loved him. Every obituary this week will lead with the Lorraine Motel. Every obituary will describe a man who carried the torch of the civil rights movement through the decades after King's death. Most will be generous. Some will be effusive. This one will try to be honest. Because Jesse Jackson always had an angle. That is not a footnote to his story. It is the story. The pattern, arrive, claim credit, move on. The Lorraine Motel incident was not an aberration. It established the operating procedure for the next six decades. Jackson was suspended from the SCLC in December 1971 for what the organization described as administrative improprieties and repeated acts of violation of organizational policy. The suspension involved questions about how Black Expo receipts were handled and about Jackson forming nonprofit corporations without SCLC authorization. He did not leave King's organization because of principal disagreement over strategy. He was pushed out by the people who knew him best, including Abernathy. Within weeks, in late December 1971, he founded Operation PUSH, People United to Save Humanity. The pattern of appropriation continued. When Jackson eventually created his Rainbow Coalition in the 1980s, he borrowed the name from a dead man who could no longer object. Fred Hampton, deputy chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party, had originated the phrase in 1969 when he united the Panthers, the Young Lords, a Puerto Rican organization, and the Young Patriots, white working-class youth, into a genuine multiracial coalition. Chicago police killed Hampton in a raid on December 4, 1969. He was 21 years old. Jackson, who was not part of Hampton's coalition and who had a difficult relationship with the Panthers, later copyrighted the Rainbow Coalition name, preventing others from using it. Former members of Hampton's coalition resented this. The Obamu episode crystallized what the pattern had become by the 2000s. Jackson had run two presidential campaigns, in 1984 and 1988, that were genuinely consequential. He registered more than a million new voters. He won more than 3.2 million primary votes in 1984 alone. He changed the Democratic Party's delegate rules from winner-take-all to proportional allocation, a change that Barack Obama would later benefit from enormously. Jackson had every right to take pride in having helped build the road Obama drove to the White House, but the spotlight had moved to someone else, and Jackson could not handle it. According to South Carolina reporter Roddy Burris, who interviewed Jackson in September 2007 following an hour-long speech at Benedict College, Jackson said Obama was acting like he's white in his handling of the Gina Six case. Jackson disputed the quote. Burris stood by his reporting. Then came a moment Jackson could not dispute, because Fox News cameras captured it. On July 6, 2008, a live microphone caught Jackson during a break before a Fox News interview. He said he wanted to cut Obama's nuts off because Obama was talking down to black people. Jackson apologized. The context was Obama's Father's Day speech at a black church, in which Obama had challenged absent black fathers to step up. Jackson could not tolerate another black man claiming the pulpit of moral authority. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "I have a dream." Jesse Jackson had a franchise, and he defended it accordingly, civil rights as a business. Jackson's corporate boycott model operated on a straightforward logic. Identify a major corporation. Accuse it of insufficient minority hiring or representation. Threaten boycotts, regulatory complaints, or picket lines. Extract what Jackson called economic covenants. Declare victory. Move on to the next target. In July 1981, Jackson announced a boycott of Coca-Cola through Operation Puush. A month later, Coca-Cola agreed to a $30 million program directing funds into black-owned businesses. The WBB-MTV boycott ran from October 1985 to August 1986 and ended when the station hired minority anchors, including Lester Holt. In 1996, Jackson launched a boycott of Mitsubishi over sexual harassment allegations and minority business practices. It settled with a $200 million minority business commitment. The Viewcom arrangement was particularly instructive. Jackson filed regulatory complaints with the FCC opposing a Viewcom license transfer, then withdrew those complaints after Viewcom agreed to fund minority broadcasting initiatives through a $2 million fund initially overseen by former New York City Mayor David Dinkins. Of that fund, $680,000 went to Jackson's own citizenship education fund. The FCC's rules against Greenmail prohibit opponents of license transfers from receiving money in exchange for withdrawing complaints. The arrangement was structured to technically avoid this prohibition. The Anheuser-Busch story is where the model became impossible to separate from personal enrichment. Jackson had boycotted Anheuser-Busch. In 1998, his sons Yusuf and Jonathan acquired a majority stake in Anheuser-Busch's River North Distributing Company on Chicago's north and northwest sides. Jackson claimed he played no role in securing the deal. Subsequent reporting by the Chicago Tribune established that he had enlisted businessman Ron Burkle's support on his son's behalf. Federal investigators during the Carter administration accumulated a substantial file on Operation Puush, believing the organization was defrauding the government of millions of dollars through federal grant programs. The Reagan administration terminated the grants. No prosecution followed. Justice Department officials reportedly feared the racial and political fallout. The audits of the Puush Excel education program, which received approximately $6 million in federal grants, questioned about $1 million in spending for inadequate documentation. Perhaps the most illuminating moment of the Duke Lacrosse case came in 2006, before a single fact had been established. Jackson promised that Rainbow Puush would pay the college tuition of accuser Crystal Mangum. He added that the offer would stand, even if Mangum had fabricated her story. The charges were later dropped, the players had been falsely accused. Mangum herself admitted to fabricating the assault in December 2024. Jackson had rushed in, extended his organization's resources and credibility, and created yet another episode that critics would cite for decades. Kenneth Timmerman's 2002 book, Shakedown, Exposing the Real Jesse Jackson, published by Regnery, documents these patterns in exhaustive detail. Jackson's supporters dismissed it as a conservative hit job. The corporate records, FCC filings, and federal grant audits do not read like political opposition research. They read like a business, the anti-Semitism breaking the most vital alliance. To understand why Jackson's anti-Semitism was so damaging, you have to understand what the Black Jewish Alliance actually was. Jewish Americans were disproportionately represented across every dimension of the early civil rights movement, legal advocacy, fundraising, freedom rides, organizing. By some estimates, more than half of all white volunteers who joined the freedom rides were Jewish. At the moment of maximum legal and political leverage, this coalition had been indispensable. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 did not happen without it. Jesse Jackson spent his career methodically destroying it. In September 1979, Jackson traveled to Beirut, Lebanon, where he met with PLO leader Yasser Arafat and embraced him for a UPI photographer. American policy at the time prohibited engagement with the PLO until it recognized Israel's right to exist. Two Jewish members of Jackson's own delegation quit in protest, calling him a dangerous man unconcerned with Israel's perspective. Jackson described the meeting as a potential beachhead for United States PLO dialogue. He presented it as statesmanship. His Jewish allies presented their resignation letters. 5 years later, in January 1984, Jackson referred to New York City as Haimetown and to Jewish people as Haimies in what he believed was an off-the-record conversation with Washington Post reporter Milton Coleman. Coleman's colleague Rick Atkinson published the remarks on February 13, 1984. They appeared in the 37th paragraph of the story. Jackson initially denied making the remarks. He then acknowledged and apologized for them at a Manchester, New Hampshire synagogue 2 days before the New Hampshire primary. The apology might have mattered more if Jackson had been willing to distance himself from Louis Farrukhan. Instead, he had invited Farrukhan to introduce him at a Chicago rally. The Nation of Islam's Fruit of Islam security force served as Jackson's bodyguards during the 1984 campaign. When the Haimetown story broke, Farrukhan did not apologize. He defended Jackson and issued a warning. If you harm this brother, I warn you in the name of Allah, this will be the last one you harm. Jackson did not denounce Farrukhan for this threat or for the remarks that followed. The Black Jewish coalition, already strained, did not survive intact. Jewish donors, activists, and political leaders who had marched alongside Black Americans in the 1960s now faced a Black political leadership that used anti-Semitic slurs, embraced men who made open threats, and engaged with organizations that denied Israel's right to exist. They drew conclusions. This was not merely a PR problem for Jackson. It was a structural fracture in the coalition that had made legislative progress possible. Jackson cracked the foundation, and the building has never been fully repaired. The personal hypocrisy. In 1998, Jesse Jackson was serving as President Bill Clinton's spiritual advisor during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. He visited the White House and prayed with the president. He counseled Clinton's family on faith and unconditional love. He became, in the press coverage of the moment, a symbol of the possibility of moral redemption. At the same time, Jackson was conducting an extramarital affair with Karen Stanford, an employee at his Rainbow PUSH Coalition's Washington office. Their daughter, Ashley, was born in approximately May 1999. On January 18, 2001, Jackson issued a public statement, "This is no time for evasions, denials, or alibis. I fully accept responsibility, and I am truly sorry for my actions." Financial records showed that Jackson had been paying Stanford $3,000 per month in child support and that Rainbow PUSH had paid Stanford $35,000 in severance. CNN suspended his program, Both Sides with Jesse Jackson, in connection with the revelation. The show was later canceled. The hypocrisy was not incidental to his public persona. Jackson had built a career on moral authority, on the claim that he occupied the prophetic tradition of the Black Church, on being the man other people called when they needed righteousness. He charged into Duke before the facts were established because he needed to be seen as the guardian of justice. He visited Tupac Shakur's hospital bedside in Las Vegas in September 1996. He attended Hugo Chavez's funeral in 2013. He met with Fidel Castro, with Saddam Hussein, with Slobodan Milosevic. Time magazine journalist Jack E. White wrote in May 1999 that Jackson's foreign interventions were almost Faustian. I think he needs the rush that only bargaining with evil can provide. The moral authority was the franchise. The moral authority was the leverage. The moment his own conduct became the story, the franchise suffered a loss from which it did not recover. His son reinforced the damage. Jesse Jackson Jr. was elected to Congress from Illinois' 2nd Congressional District and seemed for a time to represent the legitimate political inheritance of his father's movement. He resigned from Congress on November 21, 2012. On February 20, 2013, he pleaded guilty to conspiring to defraud his campaign committee of more than $750,000. The funds were used for personal purchases, among them a Michael Jackson fedora, a signed guitar, and cashmere capes. He was sentenced to 30 months in federal prison. His wife, Sandra, received a separate one-year sentence for tax fraud, the real damage. The indictments above are facts. But a serious accounting of Jesse Jackson's legacy requires stepping back from the specific incidents and asking the harder question, what did 6 decades of this pattern actually cost? He gave opponents a template they could not have invented. When Operation PUSH extracted corporate concessions that enriched Jackson's family, when the ViewCom settlement channeled $680,000 to his own organization, when his sons acquired a beer distributorship from the very company their father had boycotted, it handed every opponent of racial justice a working argument. The argument was not that racism did not exist. The argument was that civil rights leadership was a business, that the leaders enriched themselves at the expense of the communities they claimed to represent, and that the appropriate response to corporate America's racial pressure campaigns was not compliance but contempt. Jackson did not invent this argument. He provided it with documentation. He fractured the coalition that had made progress possible. The legislative achievements of the 1960s required a multiracial coalition in which Jewish Americans played a disproportionate role. Jackson's PLO meeting, his Haimetown remarks, his alliance with Farrukhan, and his refusal to fully disavow Farrukhan's threats made him the most prominent black political figure in America and simultaneously the man who had done more than anyone to shatter this coalition. Jewish Americans who had marched in Selma watched him embrace Arafat. Jewish voters who had considered themselves allies of the civil rights cause heard themselves described with slurs and then watched the perpetrator refuse to denounce a man who threatened them. The damage was not theoretical. It was structural. He fathered identity politics as an electoral strategy. Jackson's 1984 and 1988 presidential campaigns were organized not around a civic philosophy or a policy program, but around the assembly of identity groups into a coalition held together by shared grievance. Farmers, women, poor people, Arab Americans, gay Americans, black Americans, a coalition defined not by what it believed, but by who it was. This was innovative in 1984. By 2026, it has become the dominant mode of Democratic Party politics, and its costs are now visible. A politics organized around grievance identity cannot easily produce governing majorities because the coalition's logic fractures along the lines of whose grievance gets priority. Jackson built this mechanism. His successors drove it over a cliff, the line to the Supreme Court. On June 29, 2023, the Supreme Court ruled 6-2 that race-based affirmative action in college admissions violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment in Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson recused herself from the Harvard case due to her prior service on Harvard's Board of Overseers. The companion case, SFFA versus UNC, was decided 6-3. The legal lineage is straightforward. Regents of UC versus Bakke in 1978 established race-conscious admissions as permissible. Grutter versus Bollinger in 2003 reaffirmed it. SFFA in 2023 overruled both. The consequences for black enrollment were immediate and measurable. Harvard's incoming class dropped from 18% to 14% black. MIT saw combined Black, Latino, and Native American enrollment fall from 25% to 16%. This editorial does not claim that Jesse Jackson caused the SFFA decision. The claim is narrower and harder to dismiss. Jackson spent decades organizing race-conscious demands for hiring, promotion, and redistribution through a model that made those demands look, at their most visible, like a protection racket. Every year that passed after the ViewCom settlement, after the Sun's beer distributorship, after Operation PUSH's federal grant problems, the colorblind constitution argument that Edward Blum eventually weaponized in court became culturally more persuasive. Jackson did not create the backlash. He fed it year after year, incident after incident, until it had enough mass to win at the Supreme Court. The people most harmed by that ruling are not Jesse Jackson. They are the black students who will not attend Harvard, the black applicants whose path just got longer and harder. They are the ones paying the price. The record deserves more than erasure. This is the section that separates an editorial from a hit piece, so let it be said plainly, Jesse Jackson's accomplishments were real. In 1983, he organized a voter registration drive in Chicago that is directly credited with electing Harold Washington as the city's first black mayor. In late December 1983, he flew to Damascus and negotiated the release of Navy Lieutenant Robert Goodman Jr., the bombardier navigator of an A-6 intruder shot down over Lebanon on December 4, 1983, and held by Syria. President Ronald Reagan welcomed Lieutenant Goodman at the White House and said Jackson's mission of mercy had earned our gratitude and our admiration. In June 1984, he negotiated with Fidel Castro and secured the release of 22 Americans held in Cuban prisons. In August 1990, following Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, he traveled to Baghdad and helped secure the release of approximately 700 foreign nationals, mostly women, children, and sick or elderly men, from Saddam Hussein's government. In May 1999, he led a faith delegation to Belgrade and negotiated the release of three American servicemen held by Slobodan Milosevic, Specialist Stephen Gonzalez, Staff Sergeant Andrew Ramirez, and Staff Sergeant Christopher Stone. His 1984 campaign registered more than 1 million new voters and won more than 3.2 million primary votes. His campaigns persuaded Democratic Party leaders to change presidential primary rules from winner-take-all to proportional delegate allocation, a change that Barack Obama would use to win the 2008 nomination. His July 17, 1984 convention speech in San Francisco, interrupted 25 times by applause and chants, remains among the most electrifying pieces of American political oratory in the second half of the 20th century. These are not footnotes. They are the core of what made Jackson's failure so consequential. He had genuine gifts. He exercised them on behalf of real people who needed help, and in those moments, he delivered. The tragedy is not that he was without substance. The tragedy is that the substance was always in competition with the hustle, and too often, the hustle won. He also endured genuine racism throughout his career, from casual dismissal to explicit threats. That is not nothing. It cost him something. It cost everyone in his position something. That cost does not excuse the damage he did. But a serious accounting acknowledges it, what the legacy actually teaches. There is a temptation, on a day like this, to resolve the contradictions into a simple verdict. To say either that the accomplishments redeem the opportunism, or that the opportunism nullifies the accomplishments. Both verdicts are too easy. The honest verdict is more uncomfortable. Jesse Jackson was the most important civil rights leader of the generation after King, and he used that position in ways that set back the cause he claimed to champion. Not every week, not in every decision, but systematically, cumulatively, in the ways that compounded over time into structural damage. He showed what happens when a movement's most prominent leader treats the movement as a vehicle for personal advancement rather than a cause larger than himself. He showed what happens when the moral authority that comes from genuine suffering is converted into leverage for financial extraction. He showed what happens when the most powerful available black political voice uses that voice to fracture alliances rather than build them. And he showed, in the dispiriting arc of his later career, watching Barack Obama accomplish what he never could, and responding by whispering to reporters and muttering into live microphones what it looks like when a man who had the potential for genuine greatness cannot get out of his own way. Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream, Jesse Jackson had an angle. America is worse off for the difference. For the full article with sources and links, visit kimmonson.com. This has been a Kim Monson News Briefing.